I'm rolling. It's always great to be on, Patrick. Thank you. Yeah, not a question I like to be asked this time, I'll tell you. Not a good year. Last year was a great year. I finished second and third in my three experts leagues. This year, I'm just trying to stay out of the cellar, and I've never finished in last place in any league ever. But here I am in 11th place in Tout Wars and the FST Experts League. I've sunk down to now about 10th place. The only league where I'm doing halfway decent is in the XFL, but I thought I was going to be a contender in that league, and I'm kind of in fourth and fifth place, kind of scuffling around because I got a bunch of underachievers like Billy Butler and Jason Hayward and Chris Medlin. So that team's not doing as well as I thought, but fourth place, fifth place is still better than 11th. So yeah, that's kind of my year this year. Yeah, it really can because I finished in third and fourth the past 2 years. So I was actually fourth and third. So I've been kind of building to have this run this year. I really thought this year was going to be the year, and it just things just haven't come together. In fact, I had an opportunity last month to trade Jason Hayward for Troy Tulowitzki, and it was just before he got hurt. So I think Tulowitzki, had he stayed healthy, would have been a nice bump for my offense, but I think this year is going to be. I'll just try to finish as high as I can and give him one last shot next year before I start rebuilding. Really, not a lot. I think in the XFL, the only thing that's gone right is I have been able to stay as high up in the standings as I have, given all the underperformers. I mentioned a few. I've also got Austin Jackson. I've got Jake Peavy. I mean, these were the core players for my team going into the season. So the fact that I've been able to cobble together enough solid players to keep me somewhat in contention is probably the only good thing I can see coming out of this season. Well, I mean, just the fact that I'm in 11th place in Tout Wars, for the second year in a row, I was trying to punt batting average at the draft, which did real well for me last year and finished in second place. But this year, not so much. And players like Yoenis Cespedes, significantly underperforming, losing Ian Kinsler for a little while. And the only solid starting pitcher I've had all season is Chris Sale, and needless to say, on the White Sox, he's not getting very many wins. So, yeah, not so good. Yeah, absolutely. I think this is wonderful theater, actually. But I think this is a completely new story going on now. I mean, before, players actually got suspended for failing a drug test. And now, they're going to be getting suspended for not necessarily failing a drug test. And I think that changes the entire story here and opens up the question as to who else out there might also not be failing a drug test yet be potentially suspendable, if you will. Given the fact that Biogenesis is just one of many, many laboratories and distribution centers for performance-enhancing drugs, who knows who else is doing what with what organization? It just completely opens up an entirely new chapter in the whole PED issue here, and I think we are at the very beginning of something completely new that's going to take us in a completely new direction. you know, I'm not even sure that it's all about the PEDs either. I mean, some of the analysts and writers are making a case that the players are coming out against Ryan Braun now, and you know, Max Scherzer and Zach Greinke. They're making cases that they're very unhappy with what he did. But if you really listen to what they're saying, they're not really coming out against him using PEDs. They're coming out against him lying. I think people are upset because he has been a better actor than everyone else. I mean, he put on an incredible performance, denying all his use of PEDs back, you know, 18 months ago, and now it comes out that he basically was just acting. So I think the players, the writers, and all of us feel like we've been duped, and we don't like that. And I think that's the issue even more than the actual PED use, because as we know, the players are still using, and it's still very prevalent. Well, the fact that Nelson Cruz is probably going to get a suspension, and he's never failed a drug test. So, and Everett Cabrera and Johnny Peralta, and so where's the evidence that they actually used? I mean, they've never failed a test. And Major League Baseball is making their case that testing is the be-all and end-all to determine whether or not players are using. And now they're saying, no, we have another method. So okay, but do we know that's the case, that we have videotape evidence of players shooting up or taking pills or what have you? You know, from what I can tell, a lot of this is names, handwritten names on really poorly kept records. I mean, it's a lot of circumstantial evidence, I'm afraid, and I just, as long as Major League Baseball continues to hail as having one of the best drug testing programs in professional sports, I think there's something else going on here that's giving them too much free license to do other things. Yeah, and it's a fair point. I guess the larger point is what else is out there that they haven't just happened to have caught, because an article was written in a Miami newspaper about Biogenesis. I mean, it's not the only company out there that's doing this stuff, so it just opens up a huge new avenue for potential research and investigation into whoever else, how many other players out there. And, you know, the fact is that there have been some sources that saying that there may be upwards of 80 players who have been touched by this whole investigation, and it's only the small core number of players who are actually going to get suspended now, but there are others out there who've been touched by this who may be guilty at some other level. So maybe the evidence isn't as strong against those guys, but it doesn't mean that they're not taking PEDs. And like I said, that's a fair point. It really begs the question of whether this testing program is even working, or what else is it hiding? I've often said, and I wrote in my article as well, do we even know that players are not given a heads up before the testers arrive to take their tests? Does it take that much to give a travel agent a little money under the table to give them a heads up when they're booking a flight for a tester to go out to Fenway Park or Petco or wherever the testing is being done? I think this is, maybe I'm being overly cynical, but I think this is something that's reality, and we have to, consider that this is a part of what's going on. And it's always going to be a cat and mouse game. So no matter what Major League Baseball does, and this is the larger issue too. Long term, as no matter what Major League Baseball does, players are always going to be looking for an edge somewhere. So if they clamp down on this now, maybe there's a new designer drug that's coming out next week that they won't be able to detect, or maybe there's another loophole somewhere that they won't be able to easily close up. So, I mean, this is not ending anytime soon, which is another reason why, Act One, Scene One, this is just the beginning here. It's horrible. It's awful. I mean, it makes my job incredibly difficult because I don't know that whether the numbers that I'm looking at are real or inflated or somehow skewed by whatever else is going on. So, I'm looking at Everett Cabrera and breakout season, all these stolen bases. Are they real? When he comes back, what is he going to do? And we have, from last year, it makes it even more difficult. The three players who got suspended last year, Melky Cabrera, Bartolo Colon, and Yasmani Grandel. I mean, what did the three of them do this year? Colon got better, Cabrera got worse, and Grandel got hurt. So we can't even draw any conclusions of what these players are going to do once their suspensions are over. So, it just muddies the waters incredibly. I've been talking about, using less precise measurements, methods for doing projections like the Mayberry method to try to widen the error bars to give us a little bit more leeway in trying to project performance and underlying skills. But I don't know if we're ever going to be able to get as good a handle on it as we need to for our fantasy games, given the massive uncertainty that PEDs have thrust upon us. That's a good question, and I agree with everything that you say. I think that in the right situations, I mean, I've taken steroids. I mean, most people take steroids for short periods of time for different medical conditions and whatnot, and under a doctor's care, they're certainly safe. From my perspective, a lot of the question comes down to why we're making such a big deal out of all this, and I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that athletes, professional athletes, are role models for our children, and we don't want them doing things that we wouldn't want our children to do. The flip side of that, and I've written about this also in the past, is that most professions come with a certain amount of risk, and when you pursue a profession and try to be the best as you can be at that profession, you take on that risk, whatever it may be. I mean, if you decide you're going to be a firefighter, you take on the risk of possibly getting hurt fighting a fire. If you're a police officer or in the military, you take on the risks associated with that. Now, if an athlete wants to be the best that they can be, and that involves taking some additional help, I think that should be a part of the risk profile that you take on when you decide to become a professional athlete. But right now, that's not an accepted perspective. It's not an accepted philosophy. So we look very down upon players using these drugs. And you know, class, as soon as we say the word drugs, that's what casts this whole negative impression on this whole thing. But really, it's just a way for someone at a certain profession to be the best that they possibly can be. But yeah, I think in a different world, in a parallel universe, this would be very different, and PEDs would be more controlled and more liberally used in a way that athletes could have access to them and use them to improve their performance. Yeah, I've read Joe's stuff and it's great. And while I don't agree with him on some of the things that he writes, I can definitely see his point on that, and it makes a lot of sense. Major League Baseball was behind the negotiating for the first, you know, few decades of the Players Association. They were constantly losing most of those contract agreements, but this is one issue that they've appeared to have found some momentum with, and so they're riding it as much as they can. And the fact that the players' union right now is not fighting as hard as they used to fight different issues back in the 80s and 90s is just helping them gain momentum on this issue. While if you take a look at what Joe wrote, he makes a good point that really it's not even about the issue anymore. It's about gaining ground and gaining power in these negotiations, and that's really all it's about. Yeah, that's actually very scary. What may be going on now? If he just suspended A-Rod according to the drug agreement, 50 games, 100 games, what have you? I mean, that's completely different. But going through this whole best interests of the game is really open up a can of worms that is I think it's going to come back to bite him. Well, this kind of came out of a column that Steve Gardner from USA Today wrote last week, where he said that fantasy leaguers love chaos. And it was a statement that kind of caught me off guard and made me wonder whether that's really true. Do we really like chaos? And the point he was making is that you know, our favorite time of year is draft day, where there's, you know, an adrenaline rush and we have to think on our feet quickly. And at this trading deadline this past week also, it was a lot of we were expecting a lot of activity. It didn't really come, but typically there's some activity in trades that force us to make some roster decisions on the fly. And that, along with the certain rules that leagues have for managing of free agent acquisition budgets, just really muddy the waters and basically creates a sense of chaos in the fantasy environment. And you think And he made the point that we thrive on that. We really enjoy that chaos. And I think to an extent we do. There's a certain excitement to it, but the game itself was founded on a sense of control, which is antithetical to that. So, you know, I took a look and looked at our rules that have evolved over time, and really we have evolved into a game that's less control and more randomness. I mean, even just simple things like our founding fathers in 1984, when they wrote Rotisserie League Baseball, talked about this game being an auction league and an eight-category game. And we've moved from auction to more snake drafts, mostly for ease of automation. But the snake drafts adds more of a bit of randomness to the process of stocking your roster. And moving from eight categories to 10 categories is more to manage. So again, it takes away some control and adds a little bit more randomness. So I guess, you know, the conclusion I drew was that, yeah, I suppose that we are moving more towards a random game. And in the end, I suppose the more random it is, the more the better chance everybody has to compete and contend and do well. So I guess that is true. Maybe we do love chaos, I guess. Don't you have to be control freaky to play this game? I think that is how it was founded. We wanted to be able to control our teams. We wanted, you know, I'm convinced that fantasy baseball arose and became popular because we were kind of sick as general fans watching our favorite players use free agency to jump from team to team. It was hard to generate some loyalty and allegiance to your team because the players changed every year. But as fantasy leaguers, and especially in keeper leagues, we could build our own teams, and we can, you know, quote unquote, own these players, and feel like we have a sense of control over these hybrid teams, if you will. So yeah, I think we did have to be control freaks, but now I think it's becoming more of a gambling game, and that, you know, these one day games is certainly feeds into that, you know, God, what am I thinking? Cut this part out, Patrick. Our need for immediate gratification and that type of thing. So we're driven to these shorter term games that provide us a quicker payback, a quicker thrill. And I think that's just our society in general. The internet has fed that for the last 10, 15 years, and that's how the industry is kind of moving. No, you're absolutely right, and that's the problem. Is if you got somebody trying out a game for the first time, a new fantasy leaguer, and he doesn't do well, he's going to be turned off by it, and you don't want to lose them before they've even engaged into the hobby. So you want to try to find a type of game format where they have as much of a chance to win as anyone else, and that means adding as much randomness and uncertainty as you can. And that's why these short-term games and games that promote more random results are very popular, because everybody thinks they can win on any given day, in any given time. Yeah, it's going well. I'm in the process of building a new website that will be launched within the next few months. And the focus of the site is going to be on looking at different innovative new game concepts. And I guess it's a good springboard here to talk about that. During the month of July, we tested out a one-month game that's just wrapped up. And we got quite a great turnout, and people have really enjoyed this. And we're going to do a survey next week to kind of fine-tune some of the rules and see how we can make this even better. And hopefully for 2014, I'll be rolling this out as the core part of this new website. And I'll also be doing a blog and some other things on this website as well. But looking at new ways to play the game and keeping things fresh is kind of a pet project of mine, has been for the past few years. So that's kind of what I've been working on. We had almost 500 people sign up. I really thought I was going to fill maybe two or three 30-team leagues, so I thought maybe 150 people. Nearly 500 people showed up, signed up, and after we filtered out all those who submitted invalid or incomplete teams, we ended up with 444 teams competing in 18 different leagues this year, which was phenomenal. I counted them up this morning. 216 of the 444 are ahead of me in the standings. I wasn't expecting such a big turnout, so I only crafted three different rosters and then just copied them among the 18 leagues. As it turned out, two out of the three were not very good. One of them, I tried to draft a $36 pitching staff. That was a mistake. The third roster I drafted was not terrible, so I'm in the middle of the pack on those leagues where that roster is being used. But still, yeah, over 200 teams are ahead of me right now. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's glass half full, glass half empty. Whatever. Yes. Sure, it's a salary cap game, so we've set prices for every player based upon their performance to date. So as of July 1st, players like Mike Trout and Chris Davis, Miguel Cabrera were at the top of the pricing. And players that had been struggling or were injured or whatnot were near the bottom. So David Price was a $1 player for this monthly league, which meant that he was on a lot of rosters. Hanley Ramirez similarly was a $1 player. Yasiel Puig was like a $6 player. So there are quite a few interesting buys there, and you couldn't roster all of them, so you still had to pick which ones you think were going to perform better in July. And they were 30-man rosters, 23 active, 7 reserve, and you could make moves twice a week before each series. So on Mondays and Fridays, you could change your roster, switch out pitchers who weren't pitching that series and put in pitchers who will, that type of thing, looking for good matchups. At the end of the month, was a 4x4 game with the hybrid categories. We used things like on-base percentage and runs produced and saves plus holds. So it was a little bit different than standard, but all in all, the response has been great. A couple of leagues had internal chats going on a regular basis, and it turned out to be a lot of fun. Sure, yeah. I mean, All-Star Week was kind of a short week, so we ran it 5 weeks instead of four. Not so much oddball, but the seven-man reserve list was critical in this game, what we found. And I think the teams that stocked those reserves with more pitchers than hitters tended to do well. For the three rosters I put together, I chose four pitchers and three hitters. And it turned out that maybe just because I was lucky enough with not too many injuries on the hitting side, but there were a few hitters on my bench that didn't get to do anything all month, and they were kind of wasted. One thing I did determine that if you're going to draft two $1 catchers, there's really no point in putting a catcher on your bench, because even if one of those catchers gets hurt, you're really not losing that much anyway, and that was a mistake I made. But you know, overall, you know, one of the leagues, a team drafted a $19 pitching staff and ran away, is running away with that league. So yeah, I mean, there were lots of different ways to do this, and it just like in traditional leagues, it all comes down to picking the right players, and that's really what it is. I'm going to try to buy low on Yoenis Cespedes. He's had a really disappointing season, but if you follow what he's been doing, his July is kind of interesting. I think he took a more deliberate approach at the plate. He raised his contact rate to over 80%, and his walk rate was up over about 11%, which was kind of different than what he'd been doing in the past. And I think maybe he's making the right adjustments that maybe the last couple of months of the season he'll do a little bit better. So I'm hoping for that. I think there's some people who may be a little bit put off by Justin Upton still after his hot start. He had horrible May and June. July was a little bit better. He batted .292 in July, but still not any power. His home run to fly ball rate was only about 4% last month. But you know, he's a talented player, and I don't think it'll take much for him to kind of put things together and maybe have a good stretch. I'm actually going to give you two, because these are two guys who are really intriguing me. The first is Bud Norris. I think on the Orioles, he's going to do really well. I think for a lot of players, the environment has a lot to do with how they can put their skills together. And this is a very highly skilled player. He hasn't done that great this year, but he's shown great skills in the past, and I think he's going to do really well in the Orioles. And the other player is Rick Porcello on the Tigers. An extreme ground ball pitcher, and if Jose Iglesias plays on a regular basis in their infield now, I think that can do wonders for him. So I'm intrigued by if Porcello can improve this these last 2 months. This one's a tough one, because he's kind of been up and down this year, but Matt Cain of the Giants was horrible in April and unfortunately horrible in July, but he was great in May and June. I mean, he actually was vintage Matt Cain in May and June, so I'm hoping he can reclaim that in August and September. Actually, talking about him, Jose Iglesias, I think playing full time, if he does, if Peralta is suspended the rest of the year, if Iglesias plays full time, I think he's really going to be exposed. He batted only .205, I guess, in July, so he's already starting to be faced with having to adjust. And he's not, you know, he was not scouted as a hitter anyway. He's a superb defender, so I think his batting is going to struggle in the second half. Yeah, I still think Yasiel Puig is way over where he should be. His batting average in July was under .300, which is the start of the decline. But if you take a look, his expecting batting average is nearly 100 points less than his batting average. His batting average on balls in play is a ridiculous .460, and his contact rate is kind of a pedestrian 75%. So I think his numbers are finally going to catch up to him. I think I'm going to sell high on Chris Archer. His strikeout to walk ratio is under 2. His batting average on balls in play is only about .220, so that's going to come back up. His strand rate is about 80%, and his expected ERA is over 4. So yeah, right now everybody is looking at him because he's only given up like one run in the last 30 innings or so. But during that time, he's faced teams like Minnesota and Houston. So I think in August and September, he's going to come back down to earth. Yeah, I'll give you two here again. Jeff Locke on the Pirates and Travis Wood on the Cubs. Both of them with sub-3 ERAs. Both of them with their expected ERAs around 4. Both of them have low batting averages on balls in play, low hit rates, high strand rates. Locke is a little bit different because he's got poor command but a high ground ball rate, whereas Wood has got better command but a low ground ball rate. But in both cases, they're far outperforming their skills levels right now. Yeah, and ground ball pitchers can tend to overperform their sabermetric gauges, but I think to the extent that he's doing it now with like a 2.30 ERA is just way too good for the underlying skills. Yeah, I'm always going to be around at Baseball HQ. You know, I've been getting some comments, people thinking that I'm disappearing, but the rumors of my demise are vastly premature here. I will be around all the time at Baseball HQ on the forums, my columns, but I will also be at this new website to be determined shortly. And my personal website, ronchandler.com, will always have updates on my whereabouts, so not going to be able to get rid of me too easily. Oh, yes, at Ron Chandler. I do tweet on a fairly regular basis. So, yeah, I'm there too. Wow, very easy to do. I will be there as well, as I always am. It is an incredible weekend. We've been doing this now almost 20 years, and a few hundred avid fantasy leaguers and writers that you read and listen to all the time will be there talking about fantasy baseball, about baseball. We'll be able to watch some of the top prospects for 2014. We've just gotten some information about the venues for the AFL games this year. They're opening up the Camelback Stadium there for one of the teams, so we'll get to see a new stadium when we go out there this fall. But it's the first weekend in November, and it's just great to be out there after the World Series is over and spend some time talking baseball with a few hundred fellow avid fantasy leaguers. It's just a tremendous time. Yeah, we were at the DoubleTree for over 10 years, 10, 12 years, but now we're at this new location, which is slightly more accessible to the highways and to the west side of the valley in Phoenix. It was always tough to travel to Peoria and Surprise stadiums, but now with Camelback there as well, there's now 3 stadiums on the west side of the valley. So this new venue, this new hotel, is right on the I-101 loop, which will make it a lot easier to get to those new stadiums. Hey, well, thank you, and I appreciate all you've done with Baseball HQ Radio and this podcast, and now twice a week, which is just great news. It just keeps growing and growing and getting better and better. Thanks, Patrick.